The next case in our calendar is 96-2006, 96-2025, Mary Ann Minton, Executrix versus Honda of America. Mr. Shea.
Good morning, Associate Justices. I'd like to reserve 6 minutes of rebuttal time. I've also reduced my associate chair of Buckley and Andrew Schiffer. 1996 U.S. decision in McConnick versus Lehrer is important for your consideration and determination of the issue of preemption in the case before you. The court stated that the purpose of Congress is the touchstone of any preemption case. I believe that you'll find that to be important in your determination of this case. In the Safety Act of 1966, there are four clauses which I want to bring your attention to that are quite important. The Purpose Clause, which states that the Act's purpose is to decrease loss of lives in auto accidents. The Definition Clause, which states that the standards are an absolute standard. And the Act provides without which the vehicle cannot even be placed for sale or distributed in the United States. Thirdly, the Enforcement Clause. No damages provision, only injunctive and penalties. If these three clauses don't give a strong indication that no preemption was intended, certainly the next clause does. The Savings Clause. Quote, compliance with any federal motor vehicle safety standard does not exempt any person from common law liability. The plain language of these four clauses are clear without looking at the congressional record for the intent of the House and Senate in adopting these provisions.
Counsel, the appellee argues that, I believe I understood their argument, that every federal court that's looked at this has found preemption. Without exception, is that correct?
I don't think that's a complete statement. Many districts, including the Sixth, have not taken a position, number one. Number two, states such as the 11th are really unsure where they are since the decision in Freightliner. The 11th before said that no airbag was preempted. After the Supreme Court's decision, which was an 11th Circuit decision in Freightliner, the court asked the Supreme Court of Georgia in March of this year whether or not a cause of action exists for a vehicle which complies with the Safety Act, which may still not be defective or may not meet the product liability law in Georgia. The Supreme Court of Georgia found in a 6-1 decision that there was a cause of action. That was returned back to the 11th Circuit and no action has been taken. And in fact, the 11th District in their certification says prior to our decision in Freightliner, we have held that. We have not heard from the 11th. But I think more importantly, that it may be true that many federal courts, a large number of federal courts, have found federal preemption. There are federal courts. When we look at the state courts, there are four state Supreme Courts who have heard this question on a no-airbag claim with a reported decision. All four of those states have found no preemption on an airbag claim. And in fact, every decision has been unanimous except Georgia, which was a decision.
Now, some of the cases you cited, state cases you cited, were cases that have been overruled by the appellate courts. Isn't that right?
No.
Okay. You're referring to
Supreme Court decisions.
Okay. Your state. But in your brief, you cited some cases that have been overruled. I want to make sure I understood that you're citing now Supreme Court cases.
Well, two of the cases are since the brief. Okay. The Georgia case was March 7th, 1997. Supreme Court of Georgia 6-1. The Arizona case was just last week, March 27th, and that's been provided to me by the lawyers for public justice. It was Arizona, a 7-0 decision. So the other two decisions were Tevis, 1995 decision in New Hampshire, which was also a unanimous decision, which was also refused cert to the Supreme Court for reversal. And in between there, we have the decision of Indiana, 1996, which found that there was no preemption, either intended or expressed.
Is the preemption issue different with respect to airbags than it might be with respect to lawsuits regarding the absence of other safety features that were known at the time, installable at the time. In other words, if you had a crash in which your client was seriously injured or killed, and you felt that some or all of the damage to your client was avoidable if the manufacturer had just installed safety feature X, which maybe they were installing on other vehicles that they manufactured, that they had the technology, all of that. Is that approach, that theory, different for airbags than it might be for other kinds of features? Is the legal...
I think the answer to that is it's case-specific and fact-specific, but an example, Supreme Court of Idaho, in a non-airbag case, against Volkswagen, where the Volkswagen did not have a lap band. It only had a shoulder harness only. No airbag, no lap band. The Supreme Court of Idaho said that there was total preemption because it appeared to them that shoulder only met the bare minimum standards set forth in Safety Act. Now, the absurdity of that is that in 1966, when the act was passed for safety, nobody drove around and only a belt that put across the shoulder. If the purpose of the act was to decrease injury, allowing Volkswagen to go without any airbag, without any lap-out, that does not meet the touchstone being the purpose of Congress to increase safety. And a rollover, there's no way to hold you in the car. With a lap belt, which would have been available, Idaho has taken a different position. In that case, airbag is not mentioned, and airbag is not part of the decision. But in the four cases we've talked about, there are no Supreme Courts, state Supreme Courts, that have had a no airbag case who have found preemption. There's only four. They're all since 1995. They've never been reversed by the Supreme Court of the United States. That is the body of law. In reportable decisions of the United States.
Mr. Shea, if we find preemption, do we nevertheless, I shouldn't ask it that way, do we ever get to 401, 402, 403, and 407 particularly on the issue of remedial measure and...
The court wouldn't need to. It's obvious from the record that the trial court did not allow the plaintiff to go into that because preemption. At page 125 of the record, the only objection that was made to the exhibits, the 16 exhibits that show the identical car with the change of A in airbag.
Yeah,
and B,
I understand the facts.
Right.
I just want to know the law now. If in fact the court finds preemption, does that end this case?
I believe it does.
So you would not have any right under your common law cause of action to present the evidentiary questions to us for a decision because it takes it out of the hands of the state court altogether?
No, I believe if you find that there is no preemption, the court would have to go back and determine whether or not the remedial care.
Yeah, I understand that. I didn't say if we find that it wasn't. I said if we find that there is preemption. Do we ever get to particularly the 407 issue, the remedial measure?
Well, we get to a different question. That is the preemption of state evidentiary laws.
That's my question.
And I believe those laws are still yours to make and yours to determine how the trials will be heard. But it's a question that I have to raise.
So if in fact the airbag question is ruled against you, there still very well could be a cause of action on the evidentiary questions to present what other things Honda did in this case to correct the problem.
Yes, right.
I mean, not for a moment am I saying that I think it's preemption because I'm still deciding that. But I just want to know if it can be a bifurcated matter.
That option would be available.
Isn't your strongest, to pick up on Justice Douglas's question, isn't your strongest argument that the design defect in the safety belt itself, the fact that they had the correct, as you said, the correct design in one year model, and now and they changed, isn't that, that seems to be your strongest argument, is it not?
Well, at trial, the problem was that we were quite handicapped. Not only was Honda allowed to use the Act as a shield against lack of airbag changes that it made, but it also became a sword, because Honda was allowed to tell the jury, permeated throughout the trial, we have to have a passive system by federal law, number one. Number two, it met the requirements. Number three, we really didn't have any alternatives or options. That was the effect of the rules as the broad scope of the preemption, so that it became a sword as well as a shield.
Well, but if, why wouldn't they? If they raised that, if they say, excuse me, we didn't have any alternatives, why couldn't you offer the airbag as the alternative in response to that?
Because of the court's order on the motion in limine.
Okay, so it went that far.
We were tied with our hands behind our back and had to face the Act as both a shield and a sword from start to end of the trial, and opening and closing and examination of witnesses.
There was evidence, though, on the although the evidence of the prior court design and then the later court design wasn't permitted, you did have an expert who testified that that seatbelt, the relative placement of the seatbelt, was a negligent design, a defective design.
Correct, but two problems with that. One was, is my expert on examination had to admit that they had to make a passive system. The other system wasn't passive. Once again, the Act became a sword, not only a shield. Secondly, it was a different car. What was the feasibility? We weren't allowed to show actual feasibility. We knew actual feasibility because we had pictures of the identical vehicle with the correct belt geometry, but we weren't allowed to show it. So the expert on the stand, once again...
But there was a reason for that. I mean, it wasn't an arbitrary decision. The court determined that later design was inextricably tied to the inclusion of an airbag. So it was a double system, wasn't it? It was an airbag and a belt in the later model. And albeit the belt was positioned differently, wasn't the argument put that position was irrelevant because you had to put in the airbag business?
The problem I have with that argument, which I was not allowed to make, is what they are telling, or what I would like to be able to explain to the jury is that people who bought the next year's car were now not only entitled to an airbag, now they're entitled to proper belt. If you don't have an airbag, aren't you more in need of a proper belt? I don't understand the logic, because the Act is being used not only as a sword and a shield, but it is blinding the jury from the real facts of engineering and life. And that's what happened in this case.
I'd like you to address, I think, that your opponent here makes the argument that really, having had a trial and having had a jury determine the liability on the defective design, that in effect this whole preemption issue is obviated by the finding of the jury that whatever design, the seatbelt wasn't the cause of Mr. Minton's death. And in fact, no, even a properly arranged seatbelt would not have prevented him from his head injuries resulting from the collision, and I guess the other car coming into the cabin of this Honda. Does that actually make this inquiry about the preemption of sort of a vain thing, because it really, the jury already heard and they found another proximate cause?
Well, no, I think looking at the jury interrogatories, it was interesting to note that there were two interrogatories, one on consumer expectancy, one on risk benefit. Different jurors, only five jurors found that the product was not protected. Three jurors actually found that it was protected. Normally, a three-quarters jury would not, I mean, there were actually three of the eight jurors that found that it was protected.
And proximate cause?
Well, proximate cause was a separate
interrogatory. There was no interrogatory in there?
Not that I recall. I do recall vividly that it was a 6-2-6-2 with three different people finding it defective. And understanding the wealth of information that was kept from them, as well as the fact that from beginning to end of the trial, that we were not allowed to talk about alternative design, remedial repair. We were not allowed to even redact the airbag information from exhibits showing proper belt geometry. And when we were asked, did it have to be passive or active, we had to sit there like a bump in the log and say, yes, because he wasn't allowed to mention the fact, but they had alternatives.
As a U.S. Supreme Court, in any preemption case in airbags, specifically reversed the court of last resort in any state.
No.
In preemption. My second question is, because it's just not important to the issue, but I didn't understand, in your brief, and you've just again said, 6-2, 6-2, you start out by saying in one page that only six members of the jury concurred, and later it says three of them did not. How many jurors were there?
Well, there was eight, but it was 6-2 and 6-2. One was on both lists. So we had three people who found it, three different people who found it defective either in consumer expectancy or risk benefit. Because one person voted on both lists.
Let me ask you this. We have, as you know, we have a rule under which a federal court can certify to the states, to the Supreme Court, issues of state law to have us give the court our opinion with respect to the status of state law. Why should we not give deference to all the courts of appeals, the federal courts of appeals that have reviewed this federal law and declared that preemption is in fact here? Is there some reason we shouldn't do that? Should we give more weight to state Supreme Court's interpretation? Should we give equal weight, or should we give more to the federal courts?
Well, I think it's very clearly that you cannot give deference to the federal court on an issue that Congress, very clearly, it is Congress. What more could they have done? They set up four clauses to say common law of the state will not be disrupted. Defenses and rights will not be affected. The obligation of this court is not to allow to take what Congress, the House, and Senate worked very hard so that it would not be misinterpreted. Whether or not federal courts have more of a federalistic tendency and move towards a federal law should be totally unpersuasive to the mandate that Congress placed before you to make sure that we don't allow all of our laws to become federalized simply because federal courts have a tendency to go that way. Most of the federal courts have gone preemption. As I've told you, in every no airbag case that is reported, the highest state Supreme Court has found almost after unanimous in every case, no preemption. Maybe it's a policy decision that you have to determine what is best for the constituency of the state that you're in. Maybe that's what it is.
Under your analysis of preemption, is there any safety standard for automobiles that you feel is preempted? Can you give an example?
In order to have the right to sell a manufacturer a vehicle, you must meet the requirements to sell. But the requirements to sell a vehicle does not mean that you will not be subject to common law liability.
That's not my question. My question is, any standard that has been established?
For requirements of conflict of federal law that did not intend to include claims of common law based upon a manufacturer's failure to exceed the absolute federal minimum standard.
So you really don't have an answer?
No, my answer is that the only one that I know of would be the fact in the 1966 Act that you have to meet those minimal standards or you cannot sell an automobile. Every manufacturer has to meet those, so they can't sell that automobile to anyone.
You've used your time, but I have another question for you, Mr. Shea. You've argued this in your brief, I think, but the argument is that if Ohio permits or says that there is no preemption, that in effect means that manufacturers that sell cars in Ohio have to be, if they want to be free of liability for not having an airbag, they'd have to install an airbag. And I think you've argued that that's not the end result of no preemption. And can you go over that with me? Give me your strongest argument on that point.
Yes, please. I will. And in fact, I think that argument is probably best stated in the recent Monroe case from Arizona. And I quote, it says, Standard 208 sets up a minimum safety standard that are uniformly applicable to all cars manufactured. Wherever tort whereas tort liability operates to encourage behavior but not the requirement, the manufacturer may weigh the risks and benefits and choose to live with an occasional lawsuit rather than change the behavior. Our position is that in those cases in Indiana and Arizona and New Hampshire and the state of Georgia, where they have found that there is not a problem, there is no federal preemption for airbags, manufacturers still and do sell automobiles without airbags. That is the requirement of the Safety Act. No state can make them put an airbag in order to be allowed to sell a vehicle. That is what is prohibited. What is not intended by Congress is that if that's all you do, that you therefore have an immunity as long as you do something that's in the statute. That clearly isn't intended, because what incentive would there be for a manufacturer to build safer and safer cars if they had an immunity as long as they had one of the items that were minimally acceptable in standard? And as Polly's position, that's really for grants of immunity above that level, which would encourage no safety advances in the United States.
If we were to accept your proposition and allow testimony about the airbag, would the defendant be allowed to also present evidence about recent evidence about the danger of airbags? Small children and small women being killed by airbags, would that be a fair
critical course? Certainly. Certainly should be able to. And in fact, if that whole question is preempted, I mean, if one has an airbag and someone's injured and you've met that standard, then we can't listen to that question either. That's the problem with preemption. Meeting that standard, if that creates immunity, then we will never have safe products. Congress never intended for the statute to be used as a sword or a shield. They intended it to be a baseline minimum so that no car would fall below that. It was not designed or created that if you meet that minimum, then you have an absolute immunity. That makes no sense. It wasn't intended. And that's why Congress put this language in there, so it would not be expressly or impliedly preempted when these cases came to you, as they have in the last, since 1995, in New Hampshire, Georgia, Indiana, and Arizona. Why federal courts always want to go preemption? I haven't argued there. I don't know. But I think they have a federalistic tendency.
Thank you, Mr. Shea. Mr. Bodie.
Good morning, Your Honor. Please report. My name is Hugh Bodie. I represent the Honda defendants in this case. This case is before this court as a result of an evidentiary ruling made by the trial judge very shortly before trial began in this case. And the ruling that the trial court made is supportable by a number of grounds, not just the federal preemption question that the courts expressed so much interest in. So I would like to briefly touch on the other grounds that support what Judge Petzl did in keeping out what amounted to about 9 photographs of and brochures of 1992 Honda Accords. This airbag issue never came up directly by any affirmative act of the plaintiff until I questioned him prior to trial why these exhibits were included. I asked Mr. Shea, we have a 1990 Honda Accord. Why are you putting in pictures and brochures of the 1992 Honda Accord? Well, I deposed your expert, and I asked him, are you going to present a claim that the 1990 Honda Accord is defective because it lacks an airbag? Mr. Shea objected, and on the record at that deposition told me that you were not. So at that point, in my mind, I was confused. What I heard back was what I felt to be a little disingenuous about those brochures and photographs of the 1992 Honda Accord, and so I filed my motion in limine. But that makes this preemption case most unusual from all the other preemption cases that have been decided, because virtually every one of those cases, if not all of them, have been decided on summary judgment on the basis of a propounded claim, a specifically stated claim that the vehicle is defective because of accident airbags.
So this is a Ford case for us to reach what appeared to be the important issue in this case?
I believe it is, Your Honor. I believe this case is preemption is being drug out to give a gloss to what amounted to a very simple evidentiary ruling by the trial court that, in fact, was harmless error because the plaintiff was allowed to present the very same evidence of the anchor point on the three-point manual belt by other means. I mean, we did not dispute that, you know, that technology existed. It existed before this car was designed. What we did, and did have the right to say, was that this car had to have a passive system. It did have a passive system. That passivity had made me one of the benefits in the risk-benefit test that the jury can consider, because at the time this car was designed, belt usage rates in the United States were low. There was a feeling that if you got passive systems, whether they be belts, bags, or soft interiors, you were going to provide protection to people.
Yeah, so you argue that the question of whether or not this belt was attached at the proper place, whether or not it was attached in a fashion that allowed too much slack and consequently contributed to the death.
We disputed that.
You disputed it, but you're saying here the plaintiff was permitted to present expert testimony on that issue, the placement of the belt, whether or not it was...
Absolutely. They redesigned the belt in the courtroom, put in their own evidence saying it should be moved so many inches rearward. We disputed that. We said this belt performed correctly. The man did not hit the steering wheel. His sternum was fractured by the belt. The belt restrained.
But you only let him show that on a 1989 model when this was a 1990 model and it was changed in the 1992 model. How is that even fair?
Your Honor.
Isn't that what happened?
Again, I say the issue wasn't raised in discovery.
I'm not talking about that now. You're talking about the merits of the issue with Justice Pfeiffer. And we ought to get the facts straight. What happened was this accident occurred in a 1990 car. The 1992 model, it was changed to move it to 7 inches or whatever it is.
No.
You presented, or had the judge let him present, a 1989 model which had a different base.
The 1992 model car, passive protection was provided by the airbag, and Honda returned to the cheaper manual belt technology for the seatbelt. The motorized seatbelt in this car is an expensive item. It's not a cheap fix. I saw that in one of the amicus briefs. It costs about as much to put in a car as an airbag. And the fact of the matter is, had we been allowed, or had we run into the airbag issue, the testimony out of Honda was there weren't enough airbags available in 1990 to equip this car. But we didn't get into that.
Counsel, assuming we get to the preemption doctrine, I'm interested in it. But you do, one, concede that preemption is implied, it's not expressed.
No, not under the Harris decision out of the Ninth Circuit. And I would also, you know, plaintiff's counsel indicated that no state Supreme Court has found preemption. Mississippi and Cooper has found both expressed and implied preemption.
Let me take you to the question that's bothering me, the underlying question on this. And that's why I ask, is this preemption issue unique in the airbag situation as compared to other kinds of situations? One, the act, federal act, is enacted with the backdrop of Corvair, Pinto, all of those things are there and presumably influenced Congress in saying this still leaves common law actions, or that language, whatever that language means. One could assume Congress is thinking about those kinds of things. And let me change the facts to some other issue. Let's take pickup trucks. There's been a lot of publicity that manufacturers of pickup trucks refuse to include the safety measures that they were required to put in automobiles as a cost issue. I mean, I don't know whether that's accurate or not. Side panel protection, headrest protection, and there's been a number of documentations of some of the hazards in pickup trucks that could have been designed out. The same safety features that were included in autos just weren't being put in pickup trucks, a cost-benefit analysis by the industry. Would, would the Act prohibit someone, is it your argument the Act would prohibit someone, say you had a pickup truck and someone has a whiplash and it goes through the rear windshield, would that Act prohibit that kind of a cause of action going forward in state court?
No.
So airbag is different?
Airbag is very different. Here's why. In the regulatory history that leads up to Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standard 208 that's at issue, the agency, National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, made a specific determination that it wanted alternatives and passive designs to be installed in the vehicle fleet because they needed data to determine which one was more effective, which one people prefer. There's a customer preference issue here too. That raised its head back when they had the interlock. You couldn't start your car without the seatbelt and the piece of nuts, and actually, you know, petition Congress to have that regulation revoked. So when you're proceeding with these restraints issues, the agency wanted, and their federal scheme was one of choice. So that makes the preemption issue, in this case, the airbag preemption issue, extremely narrow. It simply is preempted because you are trying to punish Congress for exercising an expressly allowed federal choice. You're saying, the federal law says I can do this, but you're wrong anyway. It is not about
the federal law does not prohibit them doing both.
Well, no, it doesn't prohibit them from doing both, but it allows them to do both.
And in fact, some manufacturers were doing both in 1990.
No manufacturer would provide passive valves and airbags. Nobody today.
The only reason the presumption issue gets in there is because of the inextricably, at least the trial judge felt it was inextricably tied to these other measures. Would you be prepared for us to say the airbag issue is not properly here, but certainly the movement of the linchpin back and forth in various miles could be admissible? I mean, I know your argument is going to be, but to do that, we got to show the airbag.
They did put in that they could move the anchor point. They made that testimony. They showed it. They showed examples of it. They put that in. Now,
but not that it had been done in, not that it had been done in the 1992 model.
Well, the 92 car, if you don't mention the airbag, you're allowing plaintiffs to sell to the jury an illegal car. It can't be a manual belt in 1992 by federal law.
That's the big difference. I don't know that when you say passive seatbelts, not all of us were thinking in terms of, you're talking about the kind where you open the door, the belt slides.
Yeah, it's a motorized passive belt.
And that is not the case in the 92 that wanted to be.
Correct.
They wanted to show it was just
manual.
You pull it and so they're two really, I guess maybe arguably very different things. The kind of belt that comes on a roller versus the kind you can just pull across your lap.
One you have to put on. You have to physically think about it and do it. The other, it puts itself on for you. Passive versus active. But this case, Your Honors, this case shows how the federal statute, the so-called preemption clause and the so-called savings clause are supposed to work. Our car not only met the minimum standards, of course, Your Honors know that's, everybody likes to say that all standards are minimum, no matter how high they are. This car met Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Injury Criterion by a factor of four. It well exceeded the federal standard. We presented that evidence, but we didn't say to Judge Metzl, hey, we complied with the federal standard, we get to walk. No, the jury in this case, under the so-called savings clause, got to consider the details of our design. Did it allow too much forward travel? Was it a good design? They held it was. They exonerated us. Plaintiffs got their day in court. We didn't hide behind the federal standard. The only thing we asked was that we not be punished for exercising a federally mandated right to put in a passive belt. That was the narrow issue. That's the issue that is the preemption issue in this case. And this preemption does not subsume and wipe out plaintiffs' cases and rights. It simply says, at that point in time, the federal government wanted experimentation. They wanted field data. They asked the manufacturers to do it. They told them they could, if they did this, they were compliant. And we did. We made a good belt system. We had an unfortunate accident.
Well, you made one of the three choices, right?
Correct.
All right. Is it safe to say that, is it fair then to let the jury consider whether or not you made the wrong choice and that you should have chosen the safest of the three instead of the third one down the line? Could a jury determine that?
Not in the context of 1984 when the regulation was passed and when this car was made, because it wasn't there then. That's why the choice was mandated.
Were there safer choices that you could have made?
I do not believe the data would support a claim that an airbag is safe than a passive element. Now, I'm not prepared to quote that.
Well, they're generally unsafe, I think.
And well,
when
now,
it comes to children.
No, we're now finding out that the airbag issue is as complicated as the NHTSA thought it was back in 1984, that out of position occupants, smaller occupants, children, people who tend to sit close to the front of the car. These issues, I'm familiar with them. I have cases where airbags have in fact killed people. But you got to go back to...
There was no data back in when this case was tried to that effect.
There was no data back when the regulation was made. The regulation sought to create the choice, have the cars out in the field with a variety of systems, and then study the results to make a determination. The determination ultimately has been made to mandate airbags from the 1997 model year, but that's a complicated determination based upon acceptance by the public, cost, availability of airbags, newer technology with regard to seatbelts. So, you know, the standards are a living thing. But this car was built in 1989. It was designed in 1986. So there's a lead time to design this car.
So what was the technology back then? Could you have, was there shown that you could have chosen a more safe type of mechanism, and you chose to choose one that was the minimum standard?
No, this was not a minimum standard. We did not have to use this system. We could have used a different passive system. This was a very expensive and very effective passive system. It was a system that, based on the crash test...
And the jury had all those things?
The jury had all our pre-production crash tests, 35 of them, $1 million apiece in the test of this car. $35 million of testing.
Counsel, correct me if I'm wrong in my recollection. My recollection is that when all this came into play, the car companies were not exactly enthusiastic supporters of all this safety legislation. Your company may have been. In fact, your company may have had a better track record in some of those areas than others. But I mean, if it's a close question.
Representing car companies, and I represent over a dozen of them statewide. It's not my experience that they poo poo safety.
No, not today. I mean, things have changed.
15 years, I guess I don't go back very far to the 60s on this, but
there was a time in which their posture was absolute resistance to any federal mandates.
That's a popular conception. I don't know that I agree with that. I don't know. That's fine. We're talking about the 1990 problem, of course. I know what that car could do. I know what it did do. I see my time is up.
That's what that red light means. Thank you, Mr. Bodie.
Thank you.
Mr. Shea, you've used your time, but take 30 seconds.
Yes, Your Honor. There's some mention of the state of Mississippi. There's a decision that they made over a year ago, which has been on hold. Rule 35A of their rules said that it may not be quoted, referred to in any brief or any argument made to any court because it's not final, and that it's subject to change or alteration. Additionally, my concern is that in a case where Congress has made the strongest comment about the fact that there is no preemption, if those are turned down in a case of this, which is one of the strongest cases of indication by Congress that they intended no preemption, what does that say for future cases when there's not nearly the strongest indication of no preemption?
Well, it's Mr. Shea, the red light's on, but I want to take you back to Kylie's opening statements, and that is that the absence of airbag did not appear to be a key theory of your case in fact, was denied by your expert in deposition or a statement by yourself, that that's where you were going with this case, and it wasn't until very late on in terms of some photographs that there was even an indication that you might be pursuing this theory.
That's my defense. Hi, that's where you are. You'll never page 125 of the transcript. When the objection came, the only basis that was raised was proper. There was a deposition that was taken shortly before trial, within less than 2 months before trial, when that question was raised. At that time, there was a discussion about what are we going to do about it, how are we going to approach this work. That deposition was never filed. The basis of that claim is not part of this record. It was never filed, and it's excerpt is out of context and certainly not complete. That is their argument. But that's when that arose, we said, we're going to have to address that. How are we going to address that? And it was addressed to the court by motion long before trial, by a motion in limine filed by the defense. And the court granted that motion. What was, we weren't totally shocked that they granted the motion because most state courts have not had done anything yet. What was really surprising, when the court then expanded the preemption to exclude alternative design, remedy of prior defect, feasibility of putting the belt in the right place, and then allowing the defense to use it as a sword by saying we had to do it that way, we had no other alternative. That was shocking. It was somewhat surprising that the court was no airbag. But that was a question the counsel discussed, how we're going to handle it, should we proceed, should we do it, should we make a continuance. Let's ask
you. Just before you sit down, would you read one more time that Mississippi caveat, please?
Yes. It's Mississippi Supreme Court Rule 35A, subsection B, effective 1/1/1995. No opinion under the section shall be cited, quoted, referred to in any brief argument presented in any court. And the decision of the Mississippi Court. The Mississippi case is interesting. They actually, in their discussion, talk about that the bag is preempted. And then they end it by saying, but you know, it doesn't make any difference because in Mississippi, we have no common law that would allow them to preempt.
Okay. Does the Mississippi case fall under that caveat?
Yes, it's written all over the top of the decision. In fact,
it's on the decision itself.
Correct. It's on the top of the decision, and it's never been written.
Do you know that, Mr. Bodie?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Shea. I think you'll be advised of our opinion. Thank you. Counselor are excused. We have admission on motion, so you may be excused, or you may stay if you'd like to watch the next proceeding.